The book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, getting over a little summer cold here. That's why my voice sounds so deep. I know. Don't get used to it. Walter Mosley visited the program back in 2001. He has had a long career as a novelist. He also writes a lot of other kinds of books, including science fiction. And at the time he came out to Yellow Springs to visit, he had just published a novel called Fearless Jones. This is kind of a departure for him. It was set in Los Angeles many years ago. He loves to write about Los Angeles. And Fearless Jones was quite a novel. He continues to be quite prolific, and I hope to have him on the program again sometime. But for the time being, this is our only interview with Walter Mosley, recorded back in 2001. It's the Best of the Book Nook.
Fearless Jones, a new mystery, and I think a lot of readers have been waiting for you to write a new mystery.
It's true. It's true. It's been 5 years since I've written one. You know, the idea, you know, the way I try to explain to people what it's like being a writer, so, you know, the notion in America, you know, is based on, it's so successful not necessarily because of democracy, but because of capitalism. And capitalism works because of specialization. And specialization is you put the left front tire on the Pinto. You know, that's your job. You're putting that left front tire on. And you know, if you come in one day and say, well, I'd like to install the air conditioning or the automatic transmission or whatever, you know, you want to do, they say, no, that's not your job. You're 33JL, you know, tire. And writing is a lot like that. I come to my publisher and say, well, I'm writing something different. They say, no, you write mysteries. That's your job, your specialization. And I would have a lot of trouble with it. And I think I was struggling over the last 5 years to, you know, kind of convince my publishers in the world in general that I was going to write other things, even though I love writing mysteries.
And you have been writing some other things. You put out a long essay a year or two ago called Working on the Chain Gang, Shaking Off the Dead Hand of History. And you've refused to be locked in any particular genre, but I know a lot of readers are relieved that you've put out this new mystery, and you've got some new characters who I think appeared in one of your short stories.
Yeah, Paris Minton and Fearless Jones. About 7 years ago, I think six or seven years ago, Showtime came up to me and they said they'd like me to. They were doing a thing called Fallen Angels. They were based on pulp and mystery fiction of the 40s about L.A. And, of course, there were no black people, you know, published at that time, except maybe Chester Himes, and he was even a little later, I think. And so what they did is they had one. They had a Raymond Chandler 30s mystery published where Danny Glover played Marlowe, which is kind of wonderful. And they had me write a story, and I wrote about Paris Minton and Fearless Jones. Later on, Mary Higgins Clark asked me to write a story for a collection she was doing called Thick Headed, and I did that, and so then, you know, when it came to time for me to write mysteries again, I'm going to start working on E.Z. Rollins, but you know, E.Z. is like drama verging on tragedy, and I wasn't feeling that you know dark, so I wanted to write this drama verging on comedy with Paris Minton and Fearless Jones.
You grew up in L.A., and clearly this is a landscape that haunts your dreams and your memory. I understand that you no longer reside there, but I'm guessing that you probably dream about L.A.
Huh. You know, I'm not sure if I dream about any place in particular, but Los Angeles for me is when I a certain kind of writing I do, I'm only going to write about Los Angeles. So it's certainly deep in my unconscious. And so when I start, you know, writing, I start writing about Central, you know, or you know, one of the major streets in L.A., or about the beaches or the deserts or the mountains or the forests. You know, that really resonates in my head, especially times just about when I was born or just before I was born. It seems to come back really easily to me.
Let's go back 50 years to just before you were born, and tell us what L.A. was like for a black man back in the 50s.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. What you have is you've just had World War II, in which tens of thousands, maybe even over 100,000 black men were in the war in Europe. And for the first time, they recognize that white culture, a European culture, which doesn't have that same kind of deadly Southern racism that they've been experiencing so much of their life. They're seen and as Americans and acted as Americans. My father told me once, he said, well, you know, he thought if when the Germans came, you know, he just threw out his gun and said, I'm not an American, I'm a Negro, you know. And but they were shooting at him too, he thought. And so what you have is this big transition. All these black people come back to America and decide to leave the South. If you're coming from Mississippi, you're going to go up to Illinois. If you're coming from the Western South, you're going to go up to Los Angeles or San Francisco maybe. And so you have all these people moving in. And so to say how it is a really difficult thing. You have a lot of poor whites coming up, bringing up that kind of racism. You have a lot of people in California who have not a lot of experience with black people, so don't necessarily have that kind of deep racism. And you have a city that changes every day. It only grows. Los Angeles is a city, ever since then, has only grown. It's bigger and bigger and bigger. It was beautiful then. And there was a lot of opportunities with a kind of a glass ceiling, what we talk about today as a glass ceiling. But then we didn't know what that was. The idea is a black person never thought, well, I'm not going to be a mayor. I'm not going to be a captain of industry. I would just like to have a job and to make some money and to buy a house. And all that was possible. Have my kids get an education? No problem, at least in the beginning. And so, you know, there was racism, of course, but there was also possibility and potential that black people didn't have before, so there's a great deal of hope.
Paris is an entrepreneur, and he loves books. Now, is there a little bit of you in Paris?
I don't know. Possibly, but, you know, it's really Los Angeles. It's less me and more L.A. You know, in L.A. in the 50s and the 60s, there were, you know, everything was cheap. You could rent a place for almost nothing. There were used bookstores everywhere. You just walk in and piles of National Geographics, all these books that you never heard of and never want to hear of, I think. You know, the comic books. You could buy anything in these stores. And that was kind of wonderful. And so it's less that I wanted Paris to be me. I want him to represent a part of Los Angeles. Also kind of a dream. If I was in L.A. in the 50s now, I'd do exactly the same thing. I'd rent a little storefront, start a bookstore, you know, and it would be a wonderful thing.
Fearless Jones, as we begin the book, is locked up.
Yeah.
Not surprising.
Well, he's a tough guy, And he believes in what's right. I mean, he's, you know, in my E.Z. Rollins novels, I write a lot about a guy named Raymond Alexander, Mouse, who's very deadly. He's kind of a sociopath. He's a killer. And people love him because he stands up for, you know, for what he believes in, what he thinks is right. He doesn't pay any attention to power structures or race or money or anything like that. He is important on his own level, and he makes sure that you know that. Fearless, on the other hand, though he's just as deadly and just as tough as Mouse, is a really nice guy, and he cares about people. And he has a big heart and an open heart and an intelligent heart. But of course, if you come from a poor person who should know his place in the world, if you feel like that, you're going to get into trouble, and he's into trouble very often. Though I think what Paris realizes about Fearless that even in jail, Fearless is more free than Paris is walking free in the world, because he thinks of himself as a free man.
And Fearless isn't just half bad or three quarters bad. He's all bad. And there's not many people like him.
Right, him and Mouse. Maybe one or two others.
These guys have a really tight connection, a really close friendship. And you get the feeling that they can sense what the other guy is doing, what the other guy is going to do.
Yeah, well, you know, I've always been attracted to the notion that you could have two petty criminals, and on their own, you know, one's a pickpocket and the other one, you know, breaks into, you know, parking meters or something, and they're just like minor characters in the world of crime. But when they come together, they create some kind of monstrous criminal, and they'll go out to some town, you know, and they'll kill 10 people, and they'll just go on this crime spree, and it's just this kind of amazing thing. Alone, they're nothing. And together, they're really, you know, terrible and frightening and formidable. Paris and Fearless are like that as a detective. They separately, you know, Paris is really intelligent, reads a lot of books. He's very logical. He's really smart. He'd be like one of those NMSQT finalists or something. On the other hand, Fearless is not really very smart at all. In that kind of, you know, book learning kind of way, that logical kind of way, has an incredibly intelligent heart. So he knows if you're lying to him. He knows what's going on in the situation. He knows when things are off balance. He knows what he should be doing. And he also has that talent that he knows what's going on behind his back. You know, if he looks and then he turns back again, he can tell you 3 minutes later where everything is and what they're doing. And so also he works very hard, very well under pressure. And so separately, you know, they're not much. But together, they're really brilliant.
They complement one another in a way.
Absolutely.
Fearless also knows when somebody needs some love.
Well, actually, you know, one of the things is his heart is smart, you know, if you need to be loved. He's not afraid of love. He's not afraid of passion, which is why women love him so much, because he's not afraid of any kind of passion or heat that they feel. And he does, you know, what he thinks is right. On any level and at any time. He said, one thing about that I think Paris learns from me is that every day I ever known him, he taught me something. And here's the smart one is Paris, but his intelligence could spend its whole time learning from Fearless, which I think is very true. One of the things, the two big things that I wanted to do with the book, you know, other than, you know, write a mystery that people would like to read, is to talk about one, those black entrepreneurs who were working in Los Angeles in the 50s and the 60s, you know, people who had, you know, bookstores and beauty shops and restaurants and bail bonds business and all kinds of other businesses, and even though their initiative wasn't really welcome. On the other hand, I wanted to talk about intelligence. This has less to do with particularly the black community. It's just that, you know, we talk about kinds of intelligence. There's only one kind of or two kinds of intelligence that we recognize. And so therefore, we lose a whole bunch of input, a whole bunch of possibility.
You also key in during this period of history on a very racist period that's just ended in Germany, where the Jews were persecuted as well as a lot of other groups of people. And you have Jewish people in Los Angeles who really are treated with a lot of racism as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they, you know, you have that kind of old, you know, WASP kind of power system, you know, in the police department and city hall, that it doesn't feel any kinder toward Jews than black people. Though, you know, Jews and black people have a very different background, and so, you know, when Paris and Fearless get involved with these, well, also you have the issue of that there's persecution within the community. You have those people who collaborated with the Nazis during the war. So I have a guy who collaborated with the Nazis and another guy who recognizes not the guy but the things that he stole, and is working against him. And somehow Paris and Fearless kind of haplessly and hopelessly find themselves, you know, tied up in something much larger than them and something that you would never expect black people to be involved with it. You know, there's these, you know, Israeli secret service agents, and you have this guy who collaborated with this Nazi and the money that they stole, and them trying to, you know, to gather that money together again. You have all that, but for me, and even though in a way that it's unlikely for me, it's all the same thing, which comes together when Paris is talking to one of the agents, and the agent says, he says, "Well, you know about Israel, don't you?" And Paris cuts him off, and then thinks to himself. He says, "I knew about Marcus Garvey too, and I hated to see, you know, my dream alive in another man's, you know, in another man's heart." So where you have, you know, these strong similarities between what people are trying to do, and I really enjoyed that.
Where's my homeland? In other words,
well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Marcus wanted to make our homeland. You made yours. Where's mine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm always a little leery. You gave away some good little tidbits right there without giving away the plot. I'm always a little leery with a book like this. It's such a page-turner, and it takes you so many different directions, and there's so many plot twists. you gave away a couple of little elements there that don't really tell the story.
Right.
I'm wondering what the process was for you on this book. Did you have any clue where it was going as you were writing it?
Well, certainly the ending, it completely surprised me, how it ended, just where, you know, where Paris ended up and how he was thinking. But, you know, every once in a while, I'm not trying to say anything here. I'm trying to brag or doing anything else. But, you know, every once in a while I get compared to Chandler. And you know, people talk about it. And it's interesting because or to Hammett. And the thing that interests me so much about Chandler, I mean, there isn't a lot that we have in common, really, except for we both write noir stories about Los Angeles in a certain period, or periods that are very near each other. I have. But one of the things is that, you know, Chandler's plots are kind of so wild and all over the place. I mean, they go to all kinds of different places, and you have no idea where it's going to go next or what's going to twist into or together or come together or not come together. And in that way, I've always enjoyed that about him. And though I don't always do it, sometimes with this book, certainly, the plot goes, you know, really far afield. Though that's what happens in life, you know, it does kind of go far afield. I don't think I'm as bad, you know, let's say, as Chandler in this thing. I think that it all comes back together again at the end. But I just let myself go. I just, you know, like you get in Los Angeles, you get in a car, and you drive there. When you get there, you find out what's going on.
One of your fans was out at Wright-Patterson last week receiving the First Dayton Peace Prize, former President Bill Clinton. I was listening to his speech, and he ran down this list of countries where the U.S. had interceded to try to bring peace during his administration. He was naming Bosnia and East Timor. And notable by its absence was Rwanda.
Yeah, it's a big, I mean, Clinton's White House, I mean, a lot of things I liked about Clinton's White House, Africa wasn't one of them. Nothing about his attitude, either ignoring or paying attention to Africa, made sense. Everybody knew about Rwanda. Everybody was talking about Rwanda months and months before it happened, but it was impossible to get anybody to listen. I mean, they even knew it was going to happen. So, you know, this is a bad place. A lot of people are going to get killed unless we do something, we try to help. And, of course, we didn't. Of course, the big thing is we don't really know how to. One of the problems that America has is America doesn't know how to go to somebody and help them and then leave them alone.
I don't think they had any oil, so. Yeah.
Well, there's that. I mean, there's that. We Saudi Arabia, we certainly is going to get our help. But it's not just America, but it's not America because I don't want to really blame Clinton or even Bush or anybody else because I know that politicians just do what you tell them to do. This is the thing. They do what you tell them. If you tell them, if you say it in a strong enough voice or with enough votes or whatever, they do it. They don't even have to try to convince them. You know, George Wallace, at the end of his life, you know, is this great, you know, kind of civil rights proponent, you know. It was just where his power came from. If he didn't do it, he wouldn't have any power anymore. The problem is, you know, I'll talk about Clinton or I'll talk about Bush or whoever, but really it's us. We have to gather information. The big thing about me writing about any kind of political ideas is not because I'm an expert. It's not because I know. You know, I mean, a lot of people listening right now know a lot more than me. I'm sure of it. But the idea is that we have to start talking. And if you're wrong, you know, people correct you, or if you say something right, people listen to you. Or if you bring up a subject that they may question, they say, well, let me look into that a little bit more. We all need to be involved. We all need to be writing letters to our representatives. We all need to be talking about who should we vote for and how should we vote. We all, you know, and not, you know, in that kind of, you know, business way of, you know, the Democrats or the Republicans. What's the right thing? You know, we all need to be coming together. And but the only way that we can come together is through expressing our ideas, exchanging ideas, having those ideas, you know, affect each other and then to make decisions in the world.
We've been trying to present our radio here that is incisive, compelling, intelligent. Now we're going to go to the entertainment segment, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you how you felt when Bill Clinton brought attention to your work.
Well, you know, I liked it very much, of course. You know, I had voted for him, and so that was a nice thing. You know, it wasn't somebody that I was in fighting with, though I didn't necessarily agree with everything he said. And, you know, it did very good for me. I mean, you know, not so much that it caused a lot of people to buy my book, but it did cause it that every media person in the country knew who I was. And that made a big difference. People said, oh, yeah, Walter Mosley, I know Clinton. I'll talk to him. We'll see what – maybe I can get some kind of, you know, spin on Clinton. So it helped me a great deal. It put me in the public eye, which is a great thing. I was on the front page of New York Times, all that stuff. Usually, you know, you got to be dead to be on the front page of New York Times. You know, I mean, like, you know, most people, you know, or the president.
Yeah.
And so I was very I was very pleased about that.
Either dead or in an awful lot of trouble.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
In the book Fearless Jones, Paris is in trouble for just about the entire book. And the first trouble that he encounters is in the form of a woman.
Yeah, that's Paris's trouble. I've decided this a long time ago. Paris gets in trouble with women. He can't help it. You know, he goes off, you know, and that's because he's not sure of himself, even though he's, you know, greatly sexually endowed. He's not sure of himself in the world of, you know, of interpersonal world, which Fearless really is. And so a beautiful and a powerful woman can easily throw him off balance. And he doesn't know what to do. And he really tries to avoid women as a rule, you know, because he knows all that's going to happen to him is something wrong. And, of course, it always does. He blames Fearless for getting him into trouble, but he gets into trouble an equal amount of time.
And you have some great bad guys in this book, and your bad guys are really bad. And we won't talk about them, but I really got a kick out. Some of these bad guys are just peripheral bad guys that you run into every once in a while, but you can just feel that ominous sense of doom when they're in the room.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's the world that you want to stay off. One of the things that Paris has is there's a world. The reason Fearless is in jail and Paris hasn't paid his bail because he doesn't want to get him out of jail. Because he knows that. So Fearless is not afraid of anybody, and most people are afraid of Fearless. But when Paris is with Fearless, or Fearless comes over and says, "Well, listen, I'm going to a party, or I'm in trouble." It doesn't matter. It's all the same thing because he knows he's going to be around people who just scare him to death. When you just sit there next to him, and say, "Damn, this guy, he's serious. I'm going to be in trouble," you know, that's why Paris tries to stay in his kind of small little world in his bookstore and his entrepreneurial kind of little notion of himself. But of course he can't. The idea is that, you know, if you're black or poor or whatever in America and you want to make it to that next step, there's a lot of resistance. And if you want to go there, you need to be with somebody like Fearless.
What's it like for you, Walter, to go to these events and meet your readers?
You know, I like it very much. I like the idea of I'm on this giant tour going to 20 cities, and I you know, if I didn't have to do it, I wouldn't, I think. But that being said, when I go into a place and I, you know, do a short reading and we talk for a while about, you know, various ideas, it's a lot of fun. And, you know, I think of the people who come to these things as readers rather than fans. I mean, some people are fans, you know, but most of people are kind of deep thinking people, and they see what, you know, I'm trying to do. They see the, you know, the story, and they had a good time reading it, and they laughed and stuff. But they also see, you know, that other kind of more serious, either political or philosophical side to the work, which, you know, I'm, you know, certainly there. And so it's fun to talk to people about it. You know, if I could only do it to one place and then go home, it would be nice. But doing it 20 is kind of difficult.
It's a long haul. Well, when people heard that you were going to be on the program today, I had so many people come up to me on the street, call me on the phone and said, "Walter Mosley, is he really going to be there? Really?" I mean, they get so excited and they start talking about one of your books or two of your books or three of your books, and they just, oh, God, the buzz was incredible.
Oh, that's great.
And it's really great to meet you.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's wonderful. You know, I've been writing for the last 10, 11 years. I've written, I guess, published 13 books, and I have another one coming out in November and another one, you know, 6 months after that. And so it's been a lot of fun. I love the work. I mean, it's like a perfect life for me.
What's coming out in November?
It's a book called Futureland. It's a group of 9 science fiction short stories that are interconnected. very political about the, you know, maybe 40, 50 years in the future, talking, you know, like Jacques Ellul and Mumford, not only about how the technology changes, but how people's relationships change. You know, I have this notion, you know, it was the communist ideal that the nub of the communist notion was that there would be no more private property. That's what they always said, you know. And I think that under capitalism, we'll reach that goal. Only what will happen is that nobody will own everything. Everybody will lease everything, you know?
Yeah.
Your rug, your chair, your ring, you know, everything. You say, well, would you like a diamond ring? Well, that's only, you know, that's only going to cost you about $82 a year, you know? And, you know, but it belongs to a central holding company. And, you know, but because of that, because you don't own anything, then when you go on a cycle of unemployment, which in my future is about 3 months, you have, if you know, if you do enough things wrong, or you enough trouble, enough sick, you know, you're sick too much, or you miss too many days, you talk back, you go into unemployment. That's in common ground. Common ground is beneath every major city in the country. It's like a little octangular sleep tube, and you know, rice and beans for dinner. And you stay there for 3 months, and then you come back, and you've learned your lesson. You're not going to go on unemployment again. You know, this whole notion of this future, you know, and all these people, you know, jockeying for power, and, you know, one major corporation that controls most of the countries of the world. And,
you say this is in the future? Yeah. No, just kidding.
Right. Well, no, it's that we haven't gotten there yet. But I always have the central religion being a thing called Info Church, which is, you know, vying with power against the Catholic Church, where everybody comes in. There's a guy called the Dominar, who's the head of this place, who works for one of the corporations, and you have a computer screen, and it teaches you the mysteries of the universe. So you actually get a very good education, and at the same time, it takes all of your secrets and puts it into a central database that it, you know, uses for its own, you know, purposes, run by a company named Macrosoft. But you know, you have the, but anyway, but I have this idea, these nine stories that, you know, that talking about the future and some great, you know, apocalypse actually, toward the end of it. But that's, you know, that's a lot of fun. You know, it's a lot of fun to do that. Yeah.
Sounds like it. We'll look for that one this fall. My guest has been Walter Mosley. Thanks so much, Walter.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 2001 interview with Walter Mosley for his novel, Fearless Jones. And that was quite a long interview. We only heard about half of it. So in a future segment of the Best of the Book Nook, I will bring you the second half of that interview. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And the Book Nook comes your way every Saturday morning at 7 o'clock for an hour, and every Sunday morning at 10:30 for 30 minutes. And we have a growing archive of Book Nook interviews on the WYSO website. If you want to listen to podcasts of those, we have hundreds of them available. You can listen to them at your leisure. Just go to wyso.org and click on podcast. And I didn't know at the time I scheduled Walter Mosley, when he was coming through Dayton, that that would be my only opportunity to interview him. Over the years, I have had several other chances, and they just never, ever came to fruition for whatever reason. I was talking to his publicist and just couldn't ever lock in one of those interviews. So hopefully someday, if he keeps writing the way he does, I will have another opportunity to have Walter on the program, because he is a wonderful, articulate man and a great writer. Once again, the book is Fearless Jones by Walter Mosley. It came out 18 years ago, and we recorded that interview back in 2001. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes.